Telling you, bro. It's been happening, bro.
Not too much.
Still hitting more Peggy-O's.
Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Riff Raff. Shane Terrio here, broadcasting from not sunny Southern California. It's gloomy, cold, wet Los Angeles. Not what I signed up for. Anyway, I'm out here for a while, working on a few projects. But the perfect day today, an opportunity to finish this episode with Trey Gunn that I'm really excited about. That's coming up here shortly. A couple of announcements. Yes, my website, ShaneTerrio.com, it's up. For those of you that have already signed up, thank you so much. You can sign up. It doesn't cost anything. If you do want to sign up as a Mojo VIP member, you get exclusive content. I also have lessons up there. I'm calling mini Mojo lessons. There's stuff up there now. I'm posting weekly. I've got play-along tracks. I've got picking exercise books, all kinds of things, videos about amps and blah, 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 things like that. Check it out. My buddy Dweezil Zappa and the fine folks at rewardmusic.com helped me put it together. A lot of music up there, too. All right. As always, hit me up on Facebook, Guitar Nola. No, wait. Facebook is Shane Terrio Music. Instagram is Guitar Nola. And love your feedback, comments on iTunes, and blah, blah, blah. All right, let's get to today's guest. My guest today is Mr. Trey Gunn. Really excited to have Trey on Riff Raff. Trey is probably best known for being a member of King Crimson for about 10 years, along with Adrian Belew, Robert Fripp, and Tony Levin. He's also a pioneer on the Chapman Stick and War guitar instruments, and we'll talk about that in depth. He's also got, I lost count, maybe 15 solo records. He's a prolific composer, musician. He's collaborated with, amongst others, David Sylvian, like I said, Robert Fripp, John Paul Jones, Tool, lots of other people. He's always composing and writing. I was familiar with Trey and his career, but what really struck me was his creative voice coaching. And he does workshops, and he does one-on-one counseling that I recommend. I actually took some courses with him, and we discussed creativity and, just nurturing your creative spirit, and he's really great at that. So I encourage you to check him out. TreyGunn.com. It's TreyGunn. So this is another one that we did remotely. Trey joined me from Seattle, and I was down in LA and chatted about lots of things. And here we go. I hope you enjoy it. All right, my guest today, Trey Gunn. And Trey, thank you so much for joining me.
Happy to be here. Curious about what we're going to get into.
Is it raining up there in Seattle?
Of course. Yeah, it is. It's not always raining, but it is this week. We have 6 days of drizzle.
It's a beautiful city, man. I always love going to Seattle.
Yeah, it's great. And, at least with the rain, we know we're going to have water in the summer, and it's snowing in the mountains. So
Yeah. Yeah. It's been raining here in LA, which is weird.
That's not supposed to happen.
I know. That wasn't part of the program. But, you know, we don't know each other that well. But to my listeners, I want to say that a few years ago, I stumbled across your video. And everybody needs to check this out immediately after listening to this. It's called Trey Gunn Speaks on Original Voice. And it really, man, something about that video and your message that day not only hit home and resonated with me, it actually caused me to seek you out. And I took a couple of coaching sessions from you, which I highly recommend. We'll talk about that in a minute. But, you know, what he says on this YouTube video is just golden to me. I mean, for anybody trying to go down the artistic path, you know, I mean, I've wrestled with this over the years myself. I mean, I knew about you. I knew who you were and who you played with and everything, but that really watched it about four times. I actually watched it again this morning to refresh.
What can I ask you
yes,
a question?
Yes.
What stuck out for you in that?
Well, it was, you know, it was,
I know there's a lot of things covered, but just to,
for me personally, what stuck out, and I'm sure everybody's different, was that, you know, I've been a professional musician for a long time, sideman, recording, all that stuff, had my own solo projects, but I never put that at the forefront. And just certain things you said, like, I believe I'm paraphrasing, but to find your own way is more valuable than, you know, to do what somebody else did. And,
how
you look at somebody, a great artist that you aspire to or think it's unattainable. And you said that basically, you know, they're not doing anything different than what you could have done. They just kind of stuck with it, you know, and kept making, I think you said, make a lot of shit.
Yeah.
Just make a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of nuggets that I took out of it, but those are two that I remember.
And, you know, the first one, just to clarify for people who don't think I'm too much of a jerk, I think I stated in the talk. The video is a talk that I gave mostly to a bunch of filmmakers here in Seattle. But I think it's valuable to do your own thing. But that's a bias. That's a personal bias. And, you know, there's lots of different ways to be a musician. And I'm just kind of in that talk focusing on what is it.
Sure. Yeah.
What is it like to go on a path that's not gone before? And that's kind of a, you know, we think of the creative arts, painting and whatnot, and music and writing and film or whatever. And they are creative arts, but there's a way to kind of go even deeper off the deep end where you're not even following kind of the historic line of the tradition of the genre, you know, and so that's kind of what I was trying to address. Like, how do you make a pathway where you're not, you know, a genre writer or like a jazz guitarist? Okay. You can explore, sure. But if you're in the path of you know, playing Texas swing or something, you've got to master that. And there kind of is a pathway, but right. My talk was basically, if you're going where there is no pathway, and that's my personal bias. So just,
yeah.
And
it was refreshing to hear, and how, you know, a lot of the people, I mean, I obviously have a lot of guitar players that listen to this podcast. My Wayne Krantz, the episode I did with Wayne Krantz, I believe you stumbled across that. And
yeah.
Wayne is a perfect example of what you're talking about, because not only did he go after his own style, I mean, he really, he abandoned everything before.
Like, right,
he
right.
gave up any, for him, it was, you know, bebop cliches, and he calls them his Pat Martino lines. He basically forced himself to not play any of that stuff for years. And as a result, that was a hard path, because he didn't get calls for a lot of things. He was in this weird, he's like, well, I'm a solo artist now and I got my own thing, but now what?
And he, you know, he might be our best example, yeah. Because he not only, I mean, of course, a lot of people take it, you can go further or less further in that way. But Wayne's also kind of made a kind of there's a method in his madness of how he went about that, just as a player, which I find really, really valuable. And I actually refer a lot of my particular kinds of coaching clients that I have to Wayne's method in his book, because I think it's kind of genius in its open-endedness and non-genre kind of playing. Right. I think it's brilliant. Yeah.
Well, I think that's sort of the theme of, you know, I mean, obviously I want to talk about your career and all the things you've done, King Crimson and, you know, Robert Fripp, David Sylvian, being an innovator on the Chapman stick, but this whole thing, we could do a whole episode just on creativity and how you
help people. It's a big subject. And you know, what's so awesome about it in the positive and also the negative in terms of talking about it is if you're really doing creative work, you don't know what the hell you're doing. You don't know where you're going. You can't see the future. You know, if it's really creative action that you're participating in, you can't see it. You just kind of have your, you know, you can see one or two steps, but you can't see right. seven steps. So it's crazy and crazy uncomfortable and uncertain. And, you know, Wayne's a great example. If you really want to go into the unknown, you have to leave the known behind.
Yeah.
And it's true. Nobody's going to call you for a while.
I mean, another example of that was Alan Holdsworth, you know, what an original voice that was. And you can't name an influence. I mean, he doesn't sound like anybody. It sounds like he's from outer space or something.
Even still, right? Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if you go back to his early recordings in the 80s or whatnot, it's still nobody either wanted to go there or nobody could go there or both.
Exactly. I'd like to come back to this topic, but before we dive, I mean, we've already dipped our toe in it before we get too deep in, you know, I was checking out your Wikipedia. I didn't realize you came from a punk background. Is that right?
There's a punk background. Yeah, I have I guess I had a very unusual background. Nowadays, it doesn't seem that unusual, but I kind of had a classical background as a kid and kind of kept that going while I got into the whole punk scene down in Texas. And then when I moved up to Oregon, there was a lot of, in the early 80s, there was just this kind of wave of, you know, West Coast punk bands going up and down the West Coast.
So like what punk by, what would that have been? What name some of the bands that you like?
Black Flag, oh, yeah, Circle Black Jerks, Flag. X.
Yeah.
Yeah, that kind of stuff. Other people that I don't even know where they went. Romeo Void, Suburban Lawns.
How did you end up in New York? Did you move for a gig? Or
I did. You know, I was in school and playing music out in Eugene, and then I knew that I had to go either to LA or New York. To me, I wasn't going to go to Nashville.
Yeah.
That didn't suit me, although I grew up in Texas, but still going to Nashville didn't make sense. And funny enough, I thought about moving to LA and I went down there to look around, and I actually was looking at the Chapin Stick and hanging out with people there for a bit before I moved. And I had this terror that if I moved to LA, I would just want to hang out at the beach all the time. And I wouldn't, you know, I would get distracted. So I thought, screw it, I'm going to go to New York. You know, to be honest, New York wasn't that great for me. I don't feel like it was a great time in New York. Mm-hmm. I moved in 86. So, you know, I had a lot of affinity for a lot of the New York bands in the 80s, kind of the Talking Heads, Laurie Anderson, even the Ramones and the, I don't know, just the New York vibe. But it, to me, when I kind of got there, 86, 87, that wasn't really happening anymore. Mm. And it just didn't really click for me that much. It's so hard to, you know, do, well, you know, you live there, move your, thankfully I wasn't a drummer. Moving right. your drums around in New York City is a nightmare.
But, yeah, logistically it can be.
I feel like it, and then I ended up leaving, well, I was there for about 10 years. And then I feel like actually when I left, New York started to take off again. And also the other funny irony I thought was moving to New York the time I did was pretty much when Bill Frisell and Wayne Horowitz moved out to Seattle.
Oh, wow.
At the same time. So okay. I felt like, I think I saw Bill play within the first 6 months I was in New York, and then he was out of there. So
I think
so that's how I got to New York. But I had already started working with Robert Fripp and ended up during my time of living in New York, I spent a lot of time over in England working with Robert and going to Europe quite a bit. So things were okay. It's just, it wasn't the most restful place for me to come home to.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how did you, now, were you playing exclusively Chapin Stick at that point?
When I first met Robert, I was playing guitar, and then by like, oh man, pretty quickly, like 1987, I think I started playing the stick. Mm-hmm. I was originally interested in the stick because of the tuning. Mm-hmm. I had kind of a little revelation that the story I used to tell was that I always felt like no matter what I did on the guitar, I still had Eric Clapton leaning over my shoulder. And the blues rock sense of electric guitar, as much as I love it, it just does not suit me at all. And I heard of this instrument, the Chapin Stick, and heard that it was tuned in fifths like a cello. And I was like, oh, that's interesting.
There's a way to get you out of your rut.
Exactly. But then when I first met Robert, he was using this fifth bass tuning on the guitar. And I put that on my instrument and was like, oh, I was right. It's the fourths just don't work for me. And here's the fifths. And so the guitar kind of came alive to me for me again, like maybe for a year and a half. And then I started playing the Chapin Stick. And that was it. I just, you know, similar like we were saying with Wayne, what I felt like I had to do with the tuning was put this fifth tuning on all the instruments I had and not touch the fourths ever again.
Wow.
And as confusing as that was the way to do it. And the similar when I first started playing the stick, which probably most people know, but just a quick description. It has two sets of strings. A bass set of strings and a guitar side of strings. So it has 10 strings and it's stereo and you play it mostly all tapping. We can say it's a completely tapped instrument. The traditional old school stick tuning is fifths on the bass side and fourths on the top side.
Oh, wow.
But I tune it all in fifths and I have developed different tunings over the years, and now I'm quite settled on my tuning. But one of the things that I did with the instrument to really learn it was, and actually this was a great thing about being in New York, I went on about 100 auditions, and I went on bass auditions and just showed up with a stick. And, you know, it was fantastic because I was just thrown into all these situations and I wasn't really trying to get a gig. If I got one, that would be great. And I did meet a few people along the way, but I just was thrown into, you know, a country band, different rock bands. They're in this key. I have to figure out what we're doing. And just, you know, you got your 15-minute audition.
And New York seems like it would be the type of place where, if at all, you'd get away with that, it would be in New York. You know, people would go, well, that's cool. Let's give it a shot. You know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, what are you going to do? These are the kind of auditions where you go there and there's like 15 musicians standing in the hallway.
Yeah.
And they're bringing them in every 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it was even like they put a score in front of me. And although I can read very well, I didn't know where any of the notes were. So that was cool.
That's pretty ballsy, actually.
Yeah. I mean, why not? And of course I didn't tell them I was going to show up with a stick. They were like, what the hell is that thing? I was like, yeah, just let's play. Let's play.
Well, you're talking about open tunings and Robert Fripp. I mean, I remember learning, is it Salisbury Hill, Peter Gabriel? I believe that's Robert Fripp playing acoustic guitar.
He's on that record. Yeah, that's a good question, but it doesn't sound like Robert to me. I don't know. But definitely Tony Levin plays the bass on that track.
Yeah, there's a really like an open tuning, and it's like a C tuning or something ridiculous. Like probably an Ovation neck could withstand that tension.
You know what? I'm going to check after we're done. You could be right, but I know Robert produced that record, but the guitar player was in the Letterman band.
Oh, Sid
was in the band as well back then.
Oh, okay.
And one of the things that Peter really likes, and we know from David Rhodes, who eventually became the guitar player, is they would do two guitar parts with like different kinds of open tunings, and it's like impossible to play the sound that you get with those two different tunings.
Maybe
you know,
that's
like,
what this is. Yeah.
But I don't know if he was. I don't know if he was doing that already on that record or not.
Wow, interesting.
But I do have a little story about Tony playing the bass on that, because Robert told me that I think that might have been the first time that Peter had met Tony, and they came in and they played the song for him one listen, and then he did one take.
Wow.
And that's the record.
Wow.
And the song's at 7 too, so it's very usable. I mean, it's a simple, I'm using air quotes here, simple bass line, but it's a brilliant part.
Sure is. Yeah. Well, speaking of Robert Fripp, I mean, there's a lot of things we could talk about Fripp. I think I told you, my wife is actually a big fan of David Sylvian and Robert Fripp, and we met him once, but,
nice.
And Daryl Hall still keeps in touch with him because of that record. They've had a relationship for many, many years, Sacred Songs. Which is
right.
An amazing record. The record you played on called The First Day, which I'm a big fan of, David Sylvian and Robert Fripp. And some of that, I asked you about it and you said it was recorded in multiple studios. I think some of it was done in New Orleans at SBA.
Yeah, we did some at Dreamland, Jerry Murata's studio now in Woodstock. A lot of it was there. And then we went down to... Was it Kingsway? Is that what
Kingsway.
It was called?
That was Dan Benoit's studio. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we did it down there. And then I think, you know what? It was mixed at Electric Ladyland.
No songs to sing. I believe in. Can't breathe the air. It's too thin. This far from heaven. Far from heaven and stars.
Yeah, that was a great experience. We did originally it was just a trio with Robert and David and I, and we did a couple of little tours in Japan and Italy just as a trio. No percussion, and it was pretty cool. pretty cool. In fact, one of the things I've been doing the last 5 or 6 months is digitizing all my analog tapes. And I found a bunch of cassettes from our first writing sessions in David's apartment in London.
Yeah, I saw your YouTube video where you're baking cassettes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm almost through. I've been doing ADATs now, and I've got like from my band that was on the road in the early 2000s, and I've oh man, it's a long process. I'm almost through it. I've got like 9 tapes left.
How many ADAT machines do you have?
Okay, so I had one original Blackface.
Mm-hmm. I remember those.
And then I bought 3 used. Whatever the next one
the
was,
golden.
The XTs, yeah. And check this out. So, but I can only I only set up to do 16 tracks dubs at a time, and it was working great for a while. And now all the fancy XT ones, they're crapping out on me. So I'm just down to the Blackface,
wow.
Which is, and I think what's happening is that the XTs are so sensitive about the time code that if something drops, they just freak out and stop. Mm. Whereas the Blackface, he doesn't give a shit. He's just, I'm just going to motor along here.
Said you played on 33 CDs with King Crimson. That's pretty amazing.
It's probably more than that now, because Robert keeps releasing more and more live shows. You know, let's say new business models. So Crimson stopped in like 85 with Tony and Adrian Ballou and Bill Bruford, and then there was a 10-year break, and we started up again. It was now a 6-piece with the same 4 guys, myself, and then drummer Pat Masolato, who toured with the David Sylvian Band. At that point, they put together a big, you know, regular label deal with Virgin Records, but Robert got permission for us to make an EP on our own and put it out before the Virgin Records release. And that model eventually became his own label, Discipline Records. So we kind of started this, he started this model, which is now no big deal. It's just how it is. But at the time it was pretty radical that they would actually let us put out another release or put out releases in between the major label releases. And one of Robert's ideas was that bootlegging just always drove him mad. Crazy mad for years and years. He hated it. So his idea was that we're going to undercut the bootleggers by putting out our own bootlegs that sound better than any bootleg than anybody could get of a show, and, you know, kind of kill that market. And so that's what he's done. And so there's multiple shows from every tour now. So that's kind of how it adds up.
I see. Well, that's a nice legacy to have behind you, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
And you were, I'm a big Adrian Ballou fan too. So I got to ask you something. If you got a cool story about Adrian, I'm a big fan of his.
You know, the thing about Adrian is, it's really interesting. I think. I mean, I've always been an Adrian fan, and playing with him, and we worked in his. We often worked at his place in Nashville. Mm-hmm. So we spent a lot of time at his house and with his family and in his backyard and all that. So if you listen to Robert, he's undeniably a unique player. Nobody plays like him,
right,
except Adrian can play like him and has played with him and played like him. But he also played with Zappa, you know, Laurie Anderson, David Bowie, even Paul Simon.
Yeah.
And that's a level of flexibility as a player that's, I don't know, to me, it's unsurpassed. It's kind of shocking that somebody could actually do all those contexts.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan. All the Nine Inch Nails and what's the other record he did? Tina Weymouth, that band.
Tom Tom Club.
Tom Tom Club. Yeah. Everybody thinks it's Nile Rodgers playing that rhythm part, but that's Adrian.
No, that's Adrian all over the place.
Yeah.
And you know, have you heard, I mean, this is Adrian's story, but have you heard the story about when he auditioned for Frank Zappa?
I've heard it in interviews, but not straight just, from the just, source.
I think Zappa saw him playing. I can't remember how Zappa just saw him.
It was like at a Holiday Inn, right? In Nashville.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he said, fly out to LA and, you know, audition for the band or whatever, come out and play for the day. And he showed up at the studio and Frank flew him out. He showed up at the studio and Frank put a bunch of sheet music in front of him. And Adrian said, well, I don't read music. And Frank said, oh, that's too bad. Well, nice meeting you. And Adrian was like, no. You got to let me, give me the audio. I'll go back to my hotel room and I'll come back tomorrow and we'll play through the stuff. And Frank said, you don't understand. This is not that kind of music. You don't do that. And Adrian's like, no. And he just begged him. And sure enough, Frank gave him a cassette and a cassette player. And he went back to his hotel and came back the next day and frickin' knew all the stuff.
Amazing.
And Frank was like, okay, you win.
Yeah. That Live in New York video, Baby Snakes and all that. He's star of the show. He and Bozio. Pretty ridiculous band. League of Crafty Guitarists. Were you? Did you perform some of that?
I did. I was there at the very beginning. I was on the. I went to the very third guitar craft course in 1986, I believe it was. And that's where I first got the Robert's guitar tuning of the what he calls the new standard tuning of the fifths tuning. And I was not involved for very long, but for a couple of years. Once I started playing the Chapman stick, I wasn't really involved anymore.
I remember reading Guitar Player magazine in the 80s had a, I think it was called the Crafty Guitarist. I could be wrong, but he had his monthly column and I never knew what the hell he was talking about. I could go back now and read it. It would make sense. But back then I was like, I don't even know what this is. But it was really interesting.
It's funny. I had a similar experience with, I remember reading in Musician Magazine that, you know, in the next issue was going to be Robert interviewing, Robert and John McLaughlin interviewing each other. And those two were the guys just were the kings for me. And I was like, oh, I can't wait. I'm going to find out what kind of scales they play and what kind of rhythms and like the structure. And all they talked about was like the color of keys and how they liked chocolate. And they didn't talk about any of the stuff I wanted to talk about. I wanted to hear about. I was so frustrated.
Yeah, when we had on Daryl Hall's on Live from Daryl's House, we had Ben Folds as a guest once, and Ben chose two or three songs off of Sacred Songs, and one of them is called "Don't Leave Me Alone with Her," and it's got a Fripp solo on there, which is I learned it, and it was like I think it's quintuplets. It's some weird sequence thing he does. I had to throw it in there and make sure I tried to do justice. But
yeah, and you guys did that other song that I really wanted to play with Jerry.
Babs and Babs.
No, it's like something NYC or.
That's a great record, man.
Anyway, oh wait, is that off the Exposure record?
Well, I think they're kind of the same record now. Like I think they combined them. Maybe I forget. Daryl told me this story. I mean, because it was shelved for years.
Yeah,
I think they sort of combined them. You might be right. It might be on Exposure, which was
You guys rocked that tune, and made me want to play it.
Yeah, well, he says he's a fan of the show because I know Daryl's in touch with him. Daryl's like, "Why don't you come on the show?" And he never replies. But I remember years ago, man, going. I got invited to go to hear Joe Satriani and Steve Vai. The band I was playing with at the time had the same management company. So of course these were like my heroes. So I got to go backstage and there's this little English guy making tea dressed in a 3-piece suit, little round glasses. And my wife goes, "Is that Robert Fripp?" I go, "Yeah, I think it is." "Oh my God." It's like, "Wow, really? You even know who Robert Fripp is?" And he came over to us and was so nice. And you know, he said, I think he bowed to her and said, "Konnichiwa," because she's Japanese. Japanese, you know.
Right.
It was like she was just blown away. Wow. And he played through an Aventide and just did a solo set. It was really great. Think forced limitations spur creativity, like versus having too many options?
Absolutely. I mean having so many options, it's easy to kind of to freeze up.
Yeah.
And you know, it's a deep question. It's easy to kind of gloss over it as a simple question, but it's actually a really deep question because let me think of an example. You know, even in terms of, let's say, how many pitches you're using is this is one thing I've been working with a lot lately is, I mean, there's a million different scales and there's all these different combinations and this and that, but we tend to think of like 7-note scales. And mm-hmm. when, at least in my view at this point, when you use all of those colors, let's say all the 7 notes of whatever Dorian mode or whatever major, doesn't matter. When you use them all, you can kind of end up with like a white light of sound. Depending on how you use it, of course, a lot of people use them in different ways, but I find what's much more interesting to me nowadays is to just have 5 notes, you know, maybe 6, but even sometimes when I'm just playing around, I like to just go down to 4 notes. Mm. And it's interesting how I'm talking about just kind of exploring at the moment, not necessarily right. making something, but you know, you make something from what you, or at least how I work and how I encourage other people is to kind of set up an exploration area, explore in there, and then take things out of that room and move them to a kind of a production or composing room, if that's mm-hmm. making sense. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about just in the play area. Mm-hmm. And for me to play with, as in this example, a really reduced set of notes, for example, just 5 notes, so much more happens. So much more the colors are more defined and they're more specific, I feel like. Even four notes, and sometimes I'll look for a combination of four or say five notes that's an unusual combination that doesn't fall into one of the normal modes for me, two things happen. One is you're kind of forced to be inventive with less materials, and it encourages just more playfulness. But also what I find is when the materials are reduced, there's just more nuance of kind of the ambiguity available, which is, it's hard for me to know whether there's a truly objective, higher quality of that with ambiguity, or it's just a personal thing that I just love it when I don't quite know what's going on. I don't know where to be super technical, I don't know where the root is. I don't know where we are.
Right.
I just love that. You know, I love it when the rhythm is confusing me. You know, of course, you know, like we started talking about punk rock, that's not how that music works. But I do find that those kind of limits are good. And, you know, I think of it in terms of like pitch or sound more than I do rhythmically.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why that is, you know. I mean, certainly one of the deaths of working in the studio is if you call up a keyboard and you start going through all the keyboard sounds to find a good one.
Right, right.
That's the end of the day, you know.
Well, that's kind of what I was alluding to earlier. I mean, you brought up harmonically, which I think is also really important, but I meant like just physically too, like, you know, less shit, less pedals, less options, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, one of the things I really like to do, and one of the things that's helped me learn my instrument really well, is to play on one string.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
And it's really changed the, one of the things we haven't really touched on is that my instrument is generally made to be held upright like a guitar, but now I'm playing it almost exclusively on my lap, like a keyboard. And that's how I look at the instrument now, is a string horizontally across my lap. And so I have spent a lot of time, and I still do, just exploring what you can do on one string, how the melodies fall on a string. And there's a lot you can do on one string. It forces you to kind of make new solutions to your, unfortunately I have to use the word problem, but really we're asking questions and trying to solve kind of a problem as musicians, artists, and the answers that we get are kind of the material we end up with. And so that's how I look at these limitations, you know, like what can I do with this? You know, what's in there? What's hiding in there?
You do coaching for sculptors and artists and, you know, painters, meaning artists, painters, musicians as well. But if somebody contacted you, I mean, like I did, could you just briefly describe the process? I know it's an individual basis, but you know, you.
Yeah. And that's part of the thing, you know, for me, I got into this coaching model because the teaching model didn't work for me. And now I have a distinction between the two, and sometimes there's a little overlap, but for me, what used to happen to me for many years, like maybe 20 years, people would come to me to learn how to play my instrument, and I would meet with them and I would tell them what to do, and then they would go away and I would never see them again. And I don't know if it's because the instrument is challenging and I told them what they needed to do and it was just too much, or it just this teaching model, which is how I, just didn't work for me, which, and to briefly describe it, the teaching model, the way I look at it is you've got some secret information that I want and share it with me. And it's kind of about the student, I'm using air quotes, but the student is underneath the teacher mm-hmm. and the teacher's above them. And they're trying to kind of impart their thing and the student's trying to get it. And the coaching model is completely different. It's both the people kind of at the same level. And the thing that didn't make sense to me about teaching was that I can teach you what I do, but that just seems ridiculous. Why should I teach you what I do? Because one, I'm already doing it and I'm better at it than you're ever going to be because I'm way ahead of you. Mm-hmm. And it just seems kind of weird for me to show people what I do and how I do things. It didn't feel genuine to me. And the coaching model is, you know, what do you want to do? Right. And then I have my resources. And, you know, some of those may be technical things. Some of them may be just observations. But really the question is, it's a different kind of mindset. The mindset is, I know I'm going around in circles a little bit here, but it's not easy to kind of get it all concisely. The teaching mindset is, I have the information, you want it. The coaching mindset is, you actually have the information. We just have to clear it and find it and make a strategy for it. So it's more about inquiry, and it's a better model, I think, for finding a unique voice. You know, it can work with anything. It's just a matter of kind of posing the right kind of questions and inquiring and making sure that that what path people think they're on is really the one that they genuinely want to be on.
Right. You
know, so I kind of poke at that, and I have a variety of people. I have people who are just kind of stuck on something, and it just helps to open it up and talk about it. I have other people who bring me compositions every single week, and we go through it, and we kind of see how well it's lining up with their vision, and it's great. I love it. I love it. It's one of the parts that I really love is when people are bringing me music and I feel like I'm not like a producer, but a little bit in the sense of like listening to the aims that the person's stating that they want to do and then listening for what the music wants to do and where they meet, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's great. I love it.
Yeah, well, you're really good at it. Well, Trey, I think I appreciate your time, man. I'm glad we could get together. And
awesome.
Virtual. But yeah, I'll put links to everything, and so people can find you on your website. I know you have a Bandcamp site. I'll put links to all that. And if you're interested in coaching, they can reach you through your website. I highly recommend it. So,
awesome.
Yeah. Well, thanks again, Trey.
Thanks for having me, and always a pleasure to catch up.
Likewise. All right.
All right. Cheers, man.
All right. There you have it, Mr. Trey Gunn. Hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Check out his music. Visit treygunn.com, TREYGUNN. He's got a great Bandcamp site as well. Tons of music up there. Hit him up for some coaching. I recommend it. Check out my website, shaneterrio.com. Go ahead and sign up. Be a Mojo VIP member. And look forward to seeing you there. Take care.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you.